one and all to a little show that we like to call Populist. I'm Steve Hafer, and with me, he's the Moderna to my Pfizer, is Kirk Trudner.
If we only had two shots in front of us, this episode might be a lot better. Oh, that kind of shot. Oh, I'm sorry.
Have you had both your shots?
Yes, I'm 5 days away from being fully vaxxed. Isn't that what the cool kids say?
Yeah, and I'm 1 week away from being fully vaxxed, so yay, we're almost identical on that. And
yes,
hopefully all of you out there are getting vaxxed also, so we can just get back to normal as soon as possible. And we'll be talking about some normal activities maybe at the end of the show, things that we're looking forward to. But for right now, what are we doing today?
We are doing episode number 18. Last week, we did what we thought were the best picture winners. This week, we're going to turn the tables, and this is going to be the best picture snubs. So we're going to look at those films that were not recognized as best pictures and maybe not even nominated for best picture, and compare our lists on this. And I'm putting the over under this week. Remember, Steve and I have not seen each other's lists. I'm putting the over under on this week at 3.5.
I too have the idea that we are going to be lower on that. So I'm going to just put it at 4.5. I'm going to be one more than you, but, yeah, as I was making my list going, I'm curious, but watch, we'll probably surprise ourselves and we'll probably have another 7.
Yeah. I mean, this was, you know, we say it every week, but this was a very rich topic to jump into. And as you and I talked a little bit about, this one's going to be a little bit more subjective than some of the other ones, other lists that we've done throughout the season. I know, at least from my point of view, some of my favorites kind of snuck in there, and I'm going to be making cases for them. But there are also some historically documented snubs of really great motion pictures that we probably both have on our list as well. So it's going to be an interesting mix.
Yeah, a lot of this is, I'm sure these have all been considered snubs by people one way or the other, but a lot of them are really the ones that I was just going, what? Are you crazy? That sort of thing. Because, you know, we all know that the Academy is an imperfect place. They always get lost in whatever is being hyped up that year, or the art film, or the emotional film, or the politics of the Academy. And, you know, you can make arguments for another film over the actual winner almost every year to some degree. But like you said, Kirk, these are films that we feel were vastly superior to the films that did win Best Picture. You know, to me, movies are supposed to entertain, to tell a story well. You know, some of them do it to a high degree of difficulty that, you know, should be rewarded, not penalized. You know, adventure films, comedies, you know, they shouldn't be slammed for doing what they do well, because it's supposed to be the best picture. Does it entertain? That's what I think, at least.
I mean, I would agree. To your point, at a certain level, when the voting takes place for the Academy Awards in all categories, it's almost a game of musical chairs. When the music stops, so when the voting is due, what movie is hot, what movie's being talked about, what movie may have come out 9 months prior that might not have the heat that something that just came out had, you know, there really is the top of mind, you know, what's hip, what's hot kind of thing. There's also, as we've talked about before with Academy voting, it's all of these politics, you know, go into it. But in my mind, with the movies that I'm going to talk about for the most part, Hollywood didn't recognize just how good these films were at the time. You know, for many years, Hollywood and the Academy just went out of its way to recognize safe, big budget, sweeping epics, the Lawrence of Arabia's, the Ben-Hur's, you know, that kind of film. In my mind, I think they've swung back the other way. You know, 10 years ago when they opened up the Best Picture nominees to include 10 Best Pictures, I know the intent was to try and get a broader range of films in there, but I think the Academy was just trying to be too smart for their own good. And all it really did was give more studios the opportunity to put Best Picture nominee on the posters that they were distributing to theaters as well. And ultimately, I think the divide between what were called award-worthy films and what regular moviegoers really want to watch really, you know, grew. I mean, in the past 20 years, the only time a best picture and popular opinion kind of intersected was Lord of the Rings, one of your favorite films, Return of the King, mm-hmm. which won both best picture and the top spot at the box office. And the 10 years prior to that, there were three best picture winners that were either first or second place at the box office, Titanic, Forrest Gump, and Rain Man. You know, in the past 10 years, I think the Academy has just tried to show just how smart they are and picking all these smaller little films, worthy films. But I think they've left out some of the, as you were saying, some of these larger films, science fiction films, adventure films, even animated films that may have deserved consideration, but might not have because of the popular and financial success.
Yeah. And I do think the Academy was also trying to make a bit of an earnest effort to give it more room so they could put an occasional comedy or an adventure, you know, sci-fi film, whatever. You know, they put Black Panther in, but then I say, well, where was Infinity War? Because I can make the argument that Infinity War was every bit as good, if not even a little better than Black Panther, you know, but and wasn't there. So it's a long history. It's an interesting history, but we'll tackle it and we'll just give our 10 takes on this. But before we get into that, let's talk about what is going to be unlisted. And for you, what are three unlisted movies that you're not going to be talking about tonight?
And this is hard, too, because I think there are a lot of films that deserved the ability to either get nominated or win Best Picture. The three that won't be in there were three films that weren't even nominated for me. And that would be in 1956, The Searchers with John Wayne. AFI called it number one Western of all time, was not even nominated. Granted, tough year. Bridge on the River Kwai, 12 Angry Men, Witness for the Prosecution, all great films. But come on, Peyton Place or Sayonara, you couldn't replace one of those with The Searchers. So that's one that yeah, I think really is worthy, but did not make my top 10. Also, 1989, Do the Right Thing, the Spike Lee film, not nominated. You had Driving Miss Daisy, Born on the 4th of July, Dead Poets Society, Field of Dreams, My Left Foot. Again, all worthy films, but man, Do the Right Thing was a pivotal movie, not only for filmmaking, but for that cast, Spike Lee. I mean, it should have had that recognition. And 1977, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Spielberg is a name that's going to be brought up a lot today. I think we can both agree on that.
Yeah.
Close Encounters wasn't even nominated. And you've got a list of Annie Hall, Goodbye Girl, Julia, Star Wars, and Turning Point. Star Wars didn't win either. So, you know, that's a year that's got a lot of conversation around it. But, you know, could you put Close Encounters in there instead of maybe Julia or The Turning Point or Goodbye Girl? Yes. So those are three that didn't make my list. But again, I think it just shows that almost every year, to your point earlier, you can find an argument to be made for one film or another, either winning or not nominated.
Yeah. Interesting points. Yeah, Star Wars, you know, considering what it was, it's kind of mind-blowing. I think if the dialogue was better within the script, that it might have been taken a little more seriously. So Close Encounters is a smarter film as far as that is concerned, in my mind. So, yeah. Well, for me, you will not be hearing me say anything about 1990's Goodfellas, which lost to Dances with Wolves. You will not be hearing me say anything about 1987's Moonstruck over The Last Emperor. And you will not hear me say anything about 2016's La La Land over Moonlight. Well, you might, but I won't mean it.
You'll start it and stop halfway through and get an envelope handed to you.
Exactly. All right. Well, with that being said, let's dig into it and let's go with your number 10.
Number 10.
Right off the bat, I'm going to go with the Kirk rule and do something a little bit different.
Yes, yes, yes.
My number 10 is from 1995. this was a film that was an very outside chance at getting nominated for Best Picture. So it qualifies as part of our conversation. But it was not even nominated for Best Documentary. And the movie is Hoop Dreams, produced by PBS. This is a film that won the Audience Award for Best Documentary at Sundance, Best Documentary from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Chicago Film Critics just called it the Best Picture. It won a Peabody Award, a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award, National Society of Film Critics Best Documentary, New York Film Critics Best Documentary, Directors Guild Outstanding Directorial Achievement in Documentary. It's in the National Film Registry, and it didn't even get a sniff at Best Documentary for the Academy Awards. Now, again, I think we're going to talk a lot about the politics of the Academy today. And in this particular case, it has been told anecdotally that the voting process back in 1995 was outdated, outmoded. It allowed a small group of people to kind of shape the way the voting went, which is the reason that the movie was not included. But Hoop Dreams is a marvelous exploration of two inner city kids who are taken to a affluent school to try and play basketball for them, and the journey that they have and what they experienced with it. Originally, it's supposed to be a 30-minute film and ended up being a 3-hour film. It's a terrific watch if you ever get a chance to see it. And the fact that the Academy didn't recognize this film in any way, shape, or form is really a blight on the Academy. And fortunately, it led to some restructuring of how the voting processes took place. And hopefully we won't run into something like this again. So my number 10, Oscar snubs, Best Picture, and in this case, Best Documentary, is Hoop Dreams.
Very nice. And our boy's back cheating again. I love it. We went a week without that. I was feeling singled out and alone on an island.
Well, everybody else was getting in on it, so I figured I had to be the standard bearer again.
Yeah, Hoop Dreams is phenomenal. It's easily one of the five best, or I think one of the five best documentaries I've seen. It's terrific. And I was working with two of the filmmakers' relatives, or the two relatives of one of the filmmakers of Hoop Dreams at the time, and they were just ecstatic through the roof when it started pulling down the festival awards and everything else. Good choice. My number 10 is one of the biggest movies that has ever been made, I think. And that was 1956, The Ten Commandments, which lost to Around the World in 80 Days, which is a fine film. Most of these things that did win are fine films, are great, good films. But ask yourself, which of the two films have I seen the most or have I ever seen? I think you're going to come up with The Ten Commandments. It's an enduring epic. It's the Cecil B. DeMille epic, both in scope and running time. It is 3 hours and 40 minutes. It is a movie for sure. It's another one of those Hollywood royalty films that we spoke about before when we talked about with Gone with the Wind and Lawrence of Arabia and those Casablanca. DeMille, what I like about this is DeMille brings the story of Moses and Exodus into big sweeping vistas with amazing costumes and colors and big characters. Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner, Ann Baxter, Yvonne DiCarlo are movie stars in this movie to the nth degree. There's a dramatic score by Elmer Bernstein, and it was just a phenomenal piece of Hollywood for sure. The Hollywood Reporter said, if there were but one print of this picture, the place of its showing would be the focus of a worldwide pilgrimage every year. It's a yearly ritual for millions. It's by far the bigger movie between that and Around the World in 80 Days. And I think it got snubbed.
So by my calculations, he gave 20 minutes to each commandment. Is that the way it worked out with Cecil? No. You're right. As we mentioned earlier, that's the kind of film that Hollywood usually recognizes. Now, in this case, Around the World in 80 Days was also another big sweeping, big film that was shot on several continents. I mean, it had that Hollywood pedigree. It was kind of like two heavyweights going up against one another. I love Around the World in 80 Days. It was one of those films that I fell in love with as a kid, and I just thought it was just an imaginative, fun, motion picture. I have seen it back, now that I'm older, and went, eh.
Yeah.
It was much better as an 8-year-old, as a 40-year-old. Whereas to your point, The Ten Commandments is very enduring. So
yeah, that's kind of my point. And David Niven, who I adore, he just doesn't have the star power that was coming through in The Ten Commandments, nor is it the same vehicle to project star power as much, but he's great in it. But yeah, it's just not holding up as well. All right. What's your number nine?
Number nine.
My number nine is, I think, my most recent snub. Looking over my list, just making sure I'm not lying here. Yeah, it is. It was from 2006. I'm guessing this may be on your list too. And that is the fact that Brokeback Mountain lost to Crash. This is widely considered one of the bigger upsets in Best Picture history. I mean, going in, Brokeback Mountain had better reviews. It had the acclaimed performances. It had the exposure. Ang Lee won Best Director, which is usually a pretty good signal. Throughout all the award season, it was getting recognition. But it still lost to Crash, which many people saw as, I don't want to say an inferior film, but less quality than Brokeback.
It's inferior. It stinks.
Wow. Send your cards and letters. I'm trying to be diplomatic here because I'm hoping we get people in the industry that listen to our show, you know, and considering every actor on the planet was in Crash, which is why we think that the Screen Actors Guild threw their support behind Crash for this movie. You know, you're talking about a very difficult contest here because you're talking about, you know, race versus, you know, the gay theme that Brokeback Mountain obviously had. It touched a nerve. I mean, if you go back and look at conservative media back in 2006, there was still a great deal of backlash against this kind of film. I think ultimately it was recognized that Brokeback Mountain was a much better film than Crash, which I think some people have called it. I think you called it terrible, awful. What was it?
I'm not going to repeat myself.
That's what editing is for. But ultimately, what I think it did do was create a watershed moment for LGBTQ portrayal in motion pictures and really opened a door for better representation. And if that's the case, then ultimately it was the winner. The Academy Award would have been nice, but having those doors broken and those ceilings shattered, I think were much more important. Nevertheless, number nine for me is Brokeback Mountain losing to Crash in 2006.
Eloquently said, and yes, it is on my list and it is way higher, and not because just the fact that Brokeback is a good mountain, but it's also that Crash is that bad. I think it's one of the biggest disparities, but eloquently said in 30 seconds.
And you, what is your number nine?
Before I talk about my number nine, I'll just say that Kirk and I are using different years. I'm using the year that the movie was made. Kirk was using the year that it was given or snubbed from the awards, from the actual award ceremony. My number nine is almost as old as the Ten Commandments, but it's actually 10 years younger. And that is the Mike Nichols directorial debut, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which lost to A Man for All Seasons. Now, once again, A Man for All Seasons, terrific film, probably very deserving, but I think Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was more so, obviously, since I'm talking about it. The film version is of Edward Albee's 1962 black comedy drama, and as I mentioned, it was Nichols' directorial debut and considered one of the best debuts ever. Man for All Seasons was kind of an Academy darling, but Virginia Woolf was nominated for 13 Oscars on its own. It was only the second film to be nominated for every eligible category, and it won for Best Actress for Elizabeth Taylor and Supporting Actress for Sandy Dennis. It also stars, as I mentioned, Richard Burton and George Segal, as he and Sandy Dennis were the young married couple. Nichols had to deal with challenging themes and an actual married pair of superstars in Burton and Taylor, and that was probably hard to work with on set. The movie is tense and emotional, but has humor as well. Virginia Woolf pushed new boundaries and set new bars for future films. And it was allowed Hollywood to make dark comedies about almost taboo subjects. And you just didn't talk about alcoholism or emotional problems. And this one set the bar and kind of gave Hollywood permission to do so. So that's mine. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
It's a great choice. And it's again, showing the embarrassment of riches that we have here. I mean, I looked at that and it was one of the first cuts that I made. Mm-hmm. I tend to be a little bit more biased against essentially stage plays made into films as opposed to the larger, bigger film type of experience.
I do too.
But that being said, very powerful film. You can't deny the talents on the screen or behind the camera for this film. And ultimately, as we said at the top of the show, I think people are recognizing, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years later, just how good this movie is. Hollywood didn't recognize how good it was or how lasting or how impactful it would be right at that moment.
Yeah, it still speaks to today's audiences. It's very good. And a lot of that is Albee's script from the play, but still they pulled it off. I think it's one of Taylor's best performances in her career. She's amazing in it. And they did reward her, thank goodness. But yeah, I do love plays, but I don't always talk about 12 Angry Men, which you mentioned earlier, one of my favorite plays and one of my favorite movies. But I'm not going to be talking about it today just because I don't think necessarily is that big of a snub. So let's move on. What is your numero ocho?
Number eight.
My number eight is the mob movie that mob guys watch. All right. If The Godfather introduced the mafia as family and humanized the mafia, then Goodfellas stripped all that veneer off and showed the mob as the mob. It was violent. It was indulgent. It was an intimate look at these characters. And instead, they rewarded Dances with Wolves, the Kevin Costner sweeping, sprawling, messy historical epic Dances with Wolves. Goodfellas has been called the best mob movie of all time by many people. It's usually Godfather or Goodfellas. I think they're the same side of the coin. As I mentioned, you know, the Godfather was a bit more of a romantic look at the mob. Not saying it wasn't violent, not saying that it wasn't an examination of a you know, a crime family and all that comes with that. But Goodfellas was much more of a realistic, clear-eyed view of what the mob was. It had great performances. Martin Scorsese, I mean, talk about a guy that has been taken to the dance how many times? I mean, this was 1990, and he didn't get his best directorial until almost 20 years later. How many great films has Martin Scorsese directed, and he didn't get his best director until, you know, 2007? To me, this was a case of rewarding Kevin Costner for all that he had done leading up to that movie. It was rewarding him for taking on this project, shepherding it, starring in it. It's got that epic feel. It's got that sweeping feel. I think Hollywood really wanted to reward a Western, which they hadn't done in a while. So they gave the Academy Award to Dances with Wolves. But in my mind, Goodfellas was much more deserving in the 1990 ceremony. So Goodfellas is my number eight.
Yeah, I do agree with you that it was more deserving. Will be in my honorable mentions, just missed. It was very, very close. And yeah, I think they were, the Academy was half as surprised that Costner did such a good job. So I think they got blown away by that. He dazzled so much on his first attempt out. All right. My number eight is the 1983 movie, The Right Stuff, over Academy favorite and popular favorite, Terms of Endearment. I'm going to take credit for this one, but I truly think Right Stuff is the more important of the two movies. The Academy just had too much endearment for Terms of Endearment in my mind. Jack Nicholson, Shirley MacLaine, James O. Brooks are all Academy darlings, and I think the Academy lost itself and just got a little too swept up in the hype. Yes, it is a very, very good movie. Don't get me wrong, and it has a very emotional ending, but The Right Stuff was taken from Tom Wolfe's bestseller, which was a great book about the early days of NASA and the test pilot squadron at Edwards Air Force Base. And Kaufman really gives this epic story of the Mercury 7 astronauts and the king of the test pilots, Chuck Yeager, and his view of the whole happenings at that time. Just the weight and the attention that it deserves and the style that it deserves. The movie captures the pioneering achievements of all of them. And so surrounded by all this absurdist political environment and the media circus that followed everything. So it just gives you a great reflection of what was going on with that time as they were trying to train the very first Mercury 7 astronauts. It's a big story. big characters, big scenes, shot in a way that feels very authentic. You almost feel like you're watching old archival footage from the Air Force or something, of like Chuck Yeager's sound breaking, breaking the sound barrier flights and so forth. It's just shot very, very well. There's amazing locations, perfect wardrobe, great effects, a hugely important movie in our industry with a star studded cast. To me, it's held up very well, very well, and will continue for years and years to come.
I could not agree more. I love The Right Stuff. I remember being intimidated by it when I sat down to watch it for the first time. I kept asking, how long is this movie?
Yeah.
And it flew by. No pun intended.
Good pun, though.
It was entertaining, informative. It was thought-provoking. All of those things. And I couldn't agree more. Doesn't mean Terms of Endearment was a bad movie. And I think that goes with all the films we're talking about today. We're not saying these other films were bad. It's just that there were some that were better than others. And I absolutely agree that The Right Stuff was a better film going experience for me than Terms of Endearment.
Yeah. Still love that. And that's one of the few films that I've actually was kind of hoping they would do a sequel of, take it into the, International Space Station and the space shuttle years and everything. But, you know, it is what it is. And I'll enjoy it for what it was.
The writer stuff.
Moving on into your number seven.
Number seven.
My number seven comes at a crossroads for Hollywood. Films were released in 1969. The ceremony was 1970. And the two films that I'll be talking about are MASH and the Academy Award winning Best Picture, Patton, with George C. Scott. If you want to talk about two diametrically opposed films in Hollywood at that point in time, these are the two films. You're talking about old Hollywood, the big biopic with a name actor and the Technicolor screen, VistaVision. I mean, it was a big film about war and about the men who fought wars and how they got us to the point we are. And, you know, conservatives love this film. Flip to the other side. You've got Robert Altman and a bunch of hippies up at the 20th Century Fox Ranch out in Malibu, California, putting together this film that really didn't have a script. The actors were constantly trying to get Altman fired because they didn't think he had a vision for what was going on. It was blood and guts, but it was freewheeling, anarchic, and it was a commentary on the horrors of war. So whereas Patton kind of, I don't want to say celebrated, but at least put a sheen on it, MASH pulled back the curtain and really showed what these individuals were going through. They did it in two in completely different ways, and Hollywood was not ready for it. And so Patton was the safe choice, the big choice. It made sense. But I think now you can look back at MASH as a turning point for how films were made through the 70s, that you could take different stylistic approaches, that you could take different storytelling chances. And it's no surprise to me that the series was a big success, not only for the people that were involved, the talent that was involved. But if you look back at MASH, it was actually an episodic film. There was really no storyline. I mean, it began with Hawkeye and Duke arriving, and it ended with Hawkeye and Duke leaving. But in between were literally just a series of vignettes, essentially unrelated, but told the story of what these people were going through, working at a mobile surgical army hospital. So my number seven was MASH losing to Patton.
Yeah, Patton was just perfectly made for the Best Picture as far as the Academy is concerned. And a big star with a big performance check, great soundtrack, and big cinematography check, and then iconic first scene where he's there in front of the flag giving the speech, you know, and so you just see everything check.
It checked all the boxes.
I agree. MASH is the better movie.
And exactly.
And it's one of those comedies that is taken in one of the worst, horrific, horrifying situations, and it's all about the human spirit, and it is better. I concur.
I love Robert Altman's comment after the award was given, where he said they gave it to the wrong war.
Well done. My number seven is from 1989. The winner was Driving Miss Daisy. And I always hate to pick on this because they're all such sweet and wonderful people with a cute little theme song. And it's a nice movie, but it should not have won over two different movies, Field of Dreams and Dead Poets Society. We already talked about Field of Dreams in episode one of the podcast a lot. So you know what? I'm going to actually talk about Dead Poets Society today. It had four nominations, only one win, but it was a great film put together by director Peter Weir, starring Robin Williams, Josh Charles, Ethan Hawke, Robert Sean Leonard, Kurtwood Smith. Driving Miss Daisy was almost forgettable exactly the year after the Oscars. The director wasn't even nominated, but few people have forgotten the beautiful films of Field of Dreams and Dead Poets Society. Seize the day was the mantra of Robin Williams and Mr. Keating. And in the movie, we watch a group of privileged boys at a prep school come together and start to view and live life kind of through a different lens. Mr. Keating's methods of teaching were unconventional for the conservative prep school, but he gets his students to new heights personally as well as scholastically until darker forces arrive toward the end. And I won't give the spoiler away for those of you who've not seen it. The last half of the film is grippingly powerful, giving us the climactic, oh, Captain, my Captain scene in the classroom as Mr. Keating is getting fired. But the whole movie has humor, joy, grief, redemption, a lot of emotion. You just feel connected to all these characters. We just find it everything in this movie. Dead Poets Society would have been my choice by far.
I think you're absolutely right. 1989 was a very tough year. You know, I mentioned Do the Right Thing earlier, but you're right. Field of Dreams is awesome. Dead Poets Society is awesome. Again, Driving Miss Daisy isn't bad, but was it as good as these other films? No, I don't agree. It was a safe choice. I think it had a lot to do also with recognizing somebody like Jessica Tandy, who was, you know, had built up an incredible body of work over the years, but really hadn't been recognized by the Academy. It was an opportunity to do that. So I completely agree with you. I think there were better choices in 89 than Driving Miss Daisy.
I know it's hard to pick on Jessica Tandy and Morgan Freeman and even Dan Aykroyd, but you know what? I'm here to do it.
You're just the guy to do it.
All right. We are moving forward into our next step, and that is number six. And Kirk, take it away.
Number six.
If Augusta National Golf Course has three holes in a row that they call Amen Corner, we are now entering Kirk's version of that, which I'm going to call Spielberg Corner. And we're going to start with number six. It's 1981. How on earth Raiders of the Lost Ark lost to Chariots of Fire is beyond me. Chariots of Fire is a nice, sweet, Vangelis scored film with lots of slow motion and running on the beach. And it's a little bit of feel good. But come on, Raiders of the Lost Ark is one of the greatest films ever made. And again, this goes back to Hollywood not knowing what they had at the time. I'm sure a lot of people looked at it and said it's a throwback to the old serials of the 30s and 40s. You know, it's a lot of fun. It's Harrison Ford. Wasn't he that guy that was in that Star Wars thing? You know, I'm sure they didn't think it had the weight that it did. But on repeated viewings, and you and I have both done repeated viewings, this movie holds up unbelievably well. There are no seams. There are no lost or unnecessary scenes. It is a perfect motion picture from the acting to the tone of the film, to the cinematography, to the wonderful John Williams score. This is almost a perfect film. Chariots of Fire, again, not a bad movie, but Raiders of the Lost Ark is what filmmaking is all about. So for me, number six, 1981, Raiders of the Lost Ark losing to Chariots of Fire.
Wait, I'm writing this down. Raiders of the Lost Ark. Never heard of it, but it sounds great. I think I should check it out sometime. You make it sound wonderful. My number six is going to continue the drive into Spielberg Corner. I guess I'm going to join with you. Like you said, it was bound to come up a few times. You could say that as good as Schindler's List was, Spielberg should have won the award two, maybe three times before that, maybe even four. And I completely concur. And this is one of those movies, and that is 1982's E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Nine nominations, four wins, box office champ that year with over $663 million, and it lost to Gandhi. Gandhi checked a lot of the boxes, as we've talked before, the Academy Best Picture boxes, but they missed the mark again. In back-to-back years, Spielberg films were overlooked, as Kirk just kind of alluded to. E.T. is not your typical sci-fi film. It has adventure, but its strengths lie in the wonder that Elliot feels at his amazing encounter with this being from another planet. And we were sucked into the growing connection and self-reflection between this unlikely pair and the others who come in contact with E.T. The film is, to me, it's a masterclass in manipulation. I remember going with my buddy and seeing this and just, oh my God, you know, here we are thinking we're all cool teenagers. And by the end of it, we're just, you know, it manipulates your emotions with the images, the wonderful music, the dialogue, and it's just much more enduring over the years than Gandhi was, even after its first year. We remember photos of Ben Kingsley as Gandhi, but that's about it. Sorry, Academy, you missed the mark big time with this one. The only reason it wasn't higher for me is, as wonderful as the special effects were for its time, E.T.'s just beginning to starting to look a little dated, kind of like the shark in Jaws, just beginning. But I almost hate to say that because they were such technological marvels of their time and way ahead of their time. But that's my number six.
I think it's an outstanding choice. And now that we move on to number five, I will concur with you.
Number five.
In 1982, E.T. should have beaten Gandhi. That is my number five. So I've got it one higher than you do. Everything you just said holds true. It is manipulative. But, man, I remember coming out of the movie just like you did, in tears. My heart was full. It is such a timeless tale of friendship. But you know what it also has is acceptance. I mean, there was never a point where the kids shunned away from this strange creature. You know, they may have been cautious in getting to know it, but they were open to it. They were open to getting to know this alien. They were open to helping it. You know, even Mom came around at the very end. You know, this is a true tale of acceptance, and it is timeless, and it's absolutely delightful. I agree with everything you said about Gandhi. I think it checked all the boxes for the Academy to make them look smart and say, you know, this is the picture we chose because it checks all these boxes. But even Richard Attenborough, the director of Gandhi, said E.T. should have won the Oscar. So that's all I need to say about that. E.T. should have won the Oscar in 1982 for Best Picture. So that's my number five.
Absolutely. I also think that E.T. and Close Encounters that you mentioned earlier really show off one of the strengths of Spielberg. It's in the small, quiet reflection scenes, like at the Indiana farm at nighttime, looking up into the big sky in Close Encounters and the little boy running off to the field. Or when Elliot and E.T. are camped out in the woods and they're trying to phone home with the contraption that E.T.'s built. And you just see the stars and the trees and you hear the wind. It's just those subtle things that are so relatable. You, yes, I've seen that, or that's so cool. It just connects with you right away. And that's part of Spielberg's real talent. He connects on so many different levels. Good choice, my friend. My number five is one of my very favorite films in the entire world. And it was not nominated at all. And for the life of me, it just infuriates me that only in the past 15 years, 20 years, has this movie really started to take its place amongst the Hollywood elite. And that is 1985's Back to the Future, which lost to Out of Africa. Out of Africa had some nice beauty shots. It had a decent sleepy theme song. Beautiful, though. But the great movie that year was the movie that had to fight to be made and then partially remade because of a huge recasting of the lead character before it became the hugely popular film that it is. It taps into the dream of what would you do if you could go back in time with the knowledge you possess. And Doc and Marty are two of the most recognizable characters in the film. It has wonderful pace, great humor, special effects and music, and most of all, its heart are the magic that are just woven to perfection. To make this, to me, the pinnacle film of almost everybody who was involved, cast, crew, director, it's all their, like, some of their best work. It has spawned sequels, homages, conventions, themed events, and screenings. It's a truly beloved classic. This is what filmmaking is all about. It's entertainment, and that's what it is, and immensely rewatchable. I get excited if one of my kids go, hey, let's watch Back to the Future. It's like, I am so in. And it was also a box office champ that year, $381 million.
You left out one thing, and that is that movie will always have a soft spot for you and I, as it was one of the first films that we saw when we became tour guides at Universal back in 84.
That's true.
It for me, it defined my career there, you know, 36 years there. And one of the last things I did before I left on my final day was go down to Courthouse Square and just hang out in front of the courthouse for a few minutes and just remind me, you know, that Back to the Future has been that theme or that through line through my entire time at Universal and will continue to be. I mean, that's a great call. You know, we always say, you know, we're going to forget something. Mm-hmm. This is one I forgot. I should have put this on there. I skipped over it, and that's my bad. I completely agree. And when we do our on second thought in a couple of weeks, I'll probably find a way of slipping that in.
Yeah. And you're so right about the working at the tour. And if I was working on any special projects for the tour or anything like that, and I had to be down in the back lot, and I would take lunch, I'd go hang out in Courthouse Square. it was just too cool and just go exploring. It was nice.
Just as a side note, one of my favorite memories of the courthouse area was a couple of us up at the tour one day, we realized that it was October 15th, 2015 or six, whatever the date was when Marty jumped ahead in the second film. Mm-hmm. And we thought, God, wouldn't it be fun to be in the location on that date? And we thought we were all so clever. We'll go down there and get a picture. We got down there and there must have been 200 studio employees down there doing the same thing, getting pictures and doing the whole thing. And that, again, it's just a testament that 35 years later, 36 years later, whatever it was, that the movie still has that kind of drawing power. And even on the tour, people still recognize the courthouse with oohs and ahs. So, you know, I completely agree with you. And this is one I missed big time.
It's a great reflection of Americana, not only because it talks about different time periods in the 50s, which is one of the favorite time periods, but it also is a reflection in what we like in our movies, the action, the humor, the special effects, the time travel. It's just, it's reflective of a lot of different things. I'd put it in a time capsule personally, if I wanted some later civilization to find out what we're about.
All right, so we have to move on to our Mount Rushmore. So why don't you make like a tree and get out of here?
All right, well, what is your
number four?
I finished my visit to Spielberg Corner with my first face on Mount Rushmore. And this is from 1998. How on earth, and I'm going to keep saying that a lot, how on earth Shakespeare in Love beat Saving Private Ryan is, again, beyond me. Honestly, if you had just shown the opening D-Day sequence, that 24-minute sequence at the beginning of the film, if you had just shown that, that should have won Best Picture. But this was an epic. This was another one of those Steven Spielberg has grown up films. But unfortunately, it went up against the Weinstein Miramax political marketing machine that year for Shakespeare in Love, very similar to what happened a couple of years earlier with The English Patient. They just inundated the trades and wined and dined the critics and wined and dined the Academy to, you know, I hate to say force its way through, but essentially that's what they did. And that's how Shakespeare in Love, a wonderfully pleasant film, it's a nice little romantic comedy, but it's nowhere near the league of Saving Private Ryan. I mean, this film is genius in so many ways. The way it was shot, the way they used Tom Hanks, you know, Hollywood's everyman actor, to be the everyman that we saw this the horrors of war through. And usually Hollywood does pick the big war epic over romantic comedies, but this wasn't the case. And again, it goes back to the internal campaigning and the politicking that was going on at the time. And, you know, the last thing I'll say about it is, this movie is accepted by many World War II veterans as the best depiction of their war ever captured on film. And if it's good enough for them, it is good enough for me. We thank you for your service. And I think they would all agree with me that Saving Private Ryan should have beaten Shakespeare in Love in 1998. And that's my number four.
Yeah, it's not on my list because I don't disagree with you. I think Saving Private Ryan is a superior movie, but I think they were close enough, and I think Shakespeare in Love is a marvelously fantastic film, and it does what it was trying to do flawlessly. So there just wasn't enough disparity between the two for me, and there was a lot of years that were things like that. But fantastic movie, and you're very right. And I think the only war movie before Saving Private Ryan that came around that really reflected stuff very well was A Bridge Too Far. But since that was more as much about British troops as it was about American troops, I understand why Saving Private Ryan speaks to the American crowd more. Good choice. My number four is another movie that was not nominated again. And much like you say for Saving Private Ryan, for the life of me, I'm not sure how it didn't even get a nomination. Oh, yes, I do, because it was a movie about a comic hero. And that is Christopher Nolan's 2008 movie, The Dark Knight, which lost to eventual winner Slumdog Millionaire. 8 nominations, 2 wins, $1 billion at the box office for Christopher Nolan's movie, starring Christian Bale, Heath Ledger, who may have one of the best movie characters of all time in his portrayal of the Joker, and he won the supporting actor for it posthumously. Michael Caine, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Aaron Eckhart, Gary Oldman, Morgan Freeman. It's a fantastic cast. Slumdog had its moments, and Dev Patel is beyond likable in it, but it falls way short in comparison to what The Dark Knight is and what The Dark Knight achieves. Not only was Heath Ledger's performance one of the greats, as I mentioned, but the movie itself, along with Iron Man, probably set the standard for modern day comic hero action movies, which, as we all know, is a dominant force in Hollywood right now. It's insanely great cast, brought in this moody, edgy, gritty feel, which was also matched in its camera work, lighting, sound, wardrobe, etc. Christopher Nolan's vision is so complete and thorough in what he created in his version of Gotham that one critic called it the movie. He called the movie a rare beast. It's a summer blockbuster with equal parts brain and brawn. While Peter Travers of Rolling Stone said, "The haunting and visionary Dark Knight soars on the wings of untamed and imagination." Slumdog just didn't give us that. Dark Knight sure did, and it was snubbed.
Yeah, what's the story is that the snubbing of Dark Knight was what led to the expansion back to up to 10 movies in 2010, just so you could include, you know, more films. I hold Slumdog Millionaire in a little bit higher esteem than you do. And I think I hold Dark Knight in a little bit lower esteem than you do. I think it's a little closer. They're both great films. And I agree with all with what you're saying. Again, having done the research we've done and the politicking and the reasoning that certain films are voted or not, I think the fact that Christian Bale can be a little prickly, that Christopher Nolan can be a little prickly, this, you know, may have had something to do with it. I also think too, that people didn't get what they were expecting with this film. And what I mean by that is, you know, hey, we're going to go see a Batman film. And you remember the Michael Keaton Batman with the Jack Nicholson Joker. It was a little bit campy. It was a little bit more of that superhero thing. And you come out of The Dark Knight and you go, wait, was that a superhero film? Was that a drama? And I think, again, Hollywood didn't know what it had at the time. And also, I think that it helped that it was defined as a trilogy as well. So you saw the full vision of it, not just that slice of it, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. And this is, I think, before Christian Bale really got his full reputation as far as the prickly actor. This is before the Terminator 3 stuff or Terminator whatever happened. And in the first movie, Batman Begins with Liam Neeson, it's a fantastic movie in itself, but I think The Dark Knight just rises a little higher and it fleshes out things that had been set up in the first movie, and Heath Ledger is amazing in it. It's just one of those iconic characters. So anyway, I like movies that break barriers, and I think this helped break the stereotype, as you mentioned before, of, oh, it's a comic book hero thing. Well, they should be taken seriously too, because there's a lot of demands. There's a high bar of what you need to do as a filmmaker, and they crushed it on this one.
You know, it's interesting too. I hope I'm not stealing some of your thunder from your last three choices, but you could also say the same thing about Empire Strikes Back. It was, you know, widely considered the best of the three Star Wars movies. I think The Dark Knight was the best of those three Batman movies, but because they're the middle film, you know, you almost feel like it's not the complete telling of the story. You know, you're only getting that chapter of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think we're going to cover a lot of this also because we always talked about it in season two that we might do an episode just about sequels and the movies within the sequels, which were, you know, the best movies within. So I think we're going to dive into this at another time.
Very cool.
Let's move on. What is your number three?
Number three.
My number three is from 1994. Really tough year. The ultimate winner in this year was Forrest Gump. Also nominated at this point in time was Pulp Fiction as well, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Quiz Show, and the movie that I think should have won the Academy Award for Best Picture that year, and that was Shawshank Redemption. You know, how close is this? If you look on IMDb, they list Shawshank at number one, Pulp Fiction at number six, and Forrest Gump at number 11 on their top 250 of all time. But for me, Shawshank was the film that had it all. You know, Forrest Gump was the comfort food film. I think that Pulp Fiction, and I mean this in a very kind way, was the junk food. And I think that Shawshank was that marvelous steak dinner. I remember coming out of that film thinking about three quarters of the way through, man, if this is just another The Wrong Guy Went to Prison kind of film, I'm going to be pissed off. And by the time I walked out, I was elated. I was walking on air. I just thought it was such a great storytelling, you know, experience. And I read a great review that said, here's the thing. The first thing you think is it's the guy who got done wrong film. Then it became a prison drama. Then it's the friendship in prison drama. Then all of a sudden, wait a minute, I'm watching an escape movie. It had all of those things at once, and then wrapped it up into a beautiful, hopeful ending. I mean, we hit rock bottom at the beginning of that film, and you know, you're depressed. It's a prison film, for goodness sakes. But then you get this beautiful, hopeful ending at the end. And somebody else said too, it was long before Morgan Freeman narrated everything. So his narration really, really resonated throughout this film. But Shawshank is one of those films that is a beneficiary of 2020 hindsight. The movie did not do well at the box office. People really didn't know what Shawshank Redemption meant. And it wasn't until it hit cable and screeners were sent out and the movie became more available on more platforms that people got a chance to see it, and its popularity and its critical acclaim rose. So again, you know, I keep going back to it. This is a film that Hollywood didn't know that they had at the time they had it. And it's only been in the intervening almost 30 years now that we've recognized Shawshank for the great film that it is. So my number three is The Shawshank Redemption losing to Forrest Gump.
Yeah, didn't make my list for the very fact of what you mentioned, that that year had three, if not four, worthy Best Picture winners. And so I hate to almost slight either because I also looked at the Pulp Fiction angle as well. I know people who worked on Quiz Show. In fact, I know the guy who wrote Quiz Show, but it's the weaker of the other three.
Puff.
Yeah. Well, the other three are, and strangely enough, that guy is also the one related to the maker of Hoop Dreams, Small World. So
good career.
Yeah. yeah. Great, great, great movie. Absolutely. My number three is, it's another one of my personal favorites, but we talked about its sister movie last week, which did win, and that is 2001's The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring by Peter Jackson, which lost to Ron Howard's A Beautiful Mind. Ron Howard probably should have or could have won for Apollo 13, yet the Academy chose to recognize him for A Beautiful Mind. And it's a nice film with a very strong performance by Russell Crowe. But Lord of the Rings is a great film, a modern epic, one of the better epics of all times in my mind. And, it's a little better than its Best Picture winner sequel, Return of the King. It's a great blend of story, effects, action, and emotion. Acting are all beautifully woven by Peter Jackson's adaptation of this J.R.R. Tolkien book, and also Jackson's directing. This movie delivered big time on one of the most popular books ever. There's the heroism, there's loyal bonds, the emotion that lifts the audience and just carries them through this magical experience. The Fellowship of the Ring ranks with the Star Wars, the Star Treks, the James Bonds, the Indiana Jones, and the Harry Potter franchises as great franchises of movie-making history and immensely rewatchable films. The Academy should have rewarded it with an Oscar as well. And strangely enough, all the Lord of the Rings, they only, as great as all three movies were, there was only one acting nomination the whole time, and that was in this one, Fellowship, and that was Ian McKellen as Gandalf.
I think you're right when we talked earlier about the Academy not giving credence to fantasy films or epic films or special effects driven films. I think this was a real good testament to that. I also think it has to do, you know, with what we just talked about, is films that are part of a larger body of work. These, you know, the trilogies, the Star Wars, the Harry Potter films, which is much more than a trilogy, you know, they feel like chapters in the story and not the overall story. So I think that may have clouded the judgment of the Academy. But by and large, I think it really was not recognizing popular culture. Fantasy can also be great filmmaking.
Yeah. And there's just so much more required of films like that to start with. And so give a guy a break. Give him an award once in a while, Academy.
Help a brother out.
All right, let's go to your number two.
Number two.
My number two can be summarized in one word: Rosebud. 1941 saw How Green Is My Valley win the Best Picture Award when it should have gone to the Orson Welles magnum opus, Citizen Kane. Lots went into this decision, I am sure. We now know that Citizen Kane is considered one of the great films of all time, great filmmaker in Orson Welles. But what a lot of people don't realize is this was his first film. He also took on a very powerful man in the person of William Randolph Hearst, basing his character of Kane somewhat on Hearst. And Hearst started a smear campaign against the film, which really derailed any chances the film had at any kind of major recognition. You know, Citizen Kane was directed, produced, and co-written by Orson Welles when he was in his mid-20s. It was a critical success right from the start, but the protracted legal battle that he had with Hearst really kind of overshadowed what this film needed to have in terms of recognition. The only Oscar that Citizen Kane ever received went to Orson Welles and Herman Mankiewicz for Best Original Screenplay. But there's no reason that film should not have won Best Picture as well. Time has only confirmed this evaluation. It is one of those films that immediately comes to mind when you're asked to list your top 10 films of all time. And that is why it sits at my number two. Citizen Kane should have won the Best Picture Oscar over How Green Is My Valley.
Didn't make my list for much of kind of the same reasons that you talked about a little while ago with me, that How Green Is My Valley is a very good movie. Also, Citizen Kane, I think, is a little overrated in its overall scope. I'm not saying it's not good. I'm not saying it's not great. And The Maltese Falcon was also there that year, which you can make an argument for that, too. So did not make it. I got to tell you, there's a couple parts of Citizen Kane where I will guarantee fall asleep every time. But that's just me. My number two is a movie that you've already mentioned, and that is the 2005 movie Brokeback Mountain, Ang Lee's film, which lost to Crash. Well, I've kind of already made my thoughts known, so I'm just not going to go into it too more. Did I mention that I think Crash is one of the worst Best Picture winners ever? Maybe I did say that. Crash was...
Steve, what do you feel about Crash? Where does Crash fall on your list?
I think it was a little superficial. I think it was a little pedestrian in its look at race relations. Did nobody any service. Where Brokeback, on the other hand, tackled its themes really, really well. It painted as what it was. It was a tragic love story, and the fear and the prejudices that love story, incurred. It's bold and it's moving, and its performances by Ledger and Gyllenhaal. It's a breakthrough film, obviously, for bringing its story to the mainstream. But it's also it's a beautiful film and a beautifully crafted film. Its catchphrase, "I wish I knew how to quit you," is memorable to say the least. I think Crash might be best known for that look of surprise that Oscar presenter Jack Nicholson had when he called off their name. And if you watch the old tapes, and he sends a look over to the side wings, and he's kind of like, "Whoa," like, didn't expect that one. I don't think anybody really did. It never should have won. Brokeback should have. And Ang Lee, let me give a little to you and his acceptance speech for best actor or best director. He didn't mention his cast once in his speech. It's like, they won the damn award for you, dude. Two lesser actors who could not have pulled that off. So I've always wanted to say that. So yeah, Ang Lee, you missed the boat on that one. But Brokeback, my number two.
I love the comment that somebody said that the normally unflappable Jack Nicholson was flapped.
Yeah. It's one of those great Oscar moments that you just love. Well, you've already talked about it. We know where we stand on that one. All right, let's get into it. But before we get into it, let's do a quick little review of our 10 through 2s. Who are yours, Kirk?
My number 10 was the 1995 omission of Hoop Dreams, not only for Best Picture, but for also Best Documentary. Number 9 was 2006, Brokeback Mountain, losing to Crash. Number 8 was Goodfellas, losing to Dances with Wolves. Number 7 was MASH, losing to Patton. 6 was Raiders of the Lost Ark, losing to Chariots of Fire. 5 was 1982's E.T., losing to Gandhi. 4 was Saving Private Ryan, losing to Shakespeare in Love. 3 was The Shawshank Redemption, losing to Forrest Gump. Number 2 was Citizen Kane, losing to How Green Is My Valley.
My number 10 was the 1956 The Ten Commandments, losing to Around the World in 80 Days, followed by the 1966 Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which lost to A Man for All Seasons. 1983, The Right Stuff, losing to Terms of Endearment, was my number 8 movie. Number 7, The Dead Poets Society, Peter Weir's film, which lost to Driving Miss Daisy in 1989. Number 6 was E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Steven Spielberg's 1982 film, which lost to Gandhi. Number 5, Back to the Future from 1985, losing to Out of Africa. Number 4, Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight from 2008, which lost to Slumdog Millionaire. Number 3, 2001, The Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, which lost to A Beautiful Mind. And number 2 was 2005, or 6, as Kirk put it, Brokeback Mountain, which lost to Crash. Now we've arrived at that moment. What is your number one greatest snub of all time?
Number one.
My number one didn't win the Academy Award because it wasn't even nominated for the Academy Award. This is 1952. The nominees were The Greatest Show on Earth, High Noon, Ivanhoe, Moulin Rouge, and The Quiet Man, and completely left out the greatest movie musical of all time, Stanley Donen's classic, Singing in the Rain. High Noon is a great film. Moulin Rouge is a great film. The Quiet Man is a great film. Ivanhoe is a decent film. The Greatest Show on Earth, to quote somebody I found on the internet, and I loved it, was an overstuffed studio nightmare that would be lucky to screen on cable at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday, let alone to get the continuing acclaim that Singing in the Rain currently enjoys. AFI called Singing in the Rain the fifth greatest movie ever, the best movie musical ever, yet this movie won 0 Oscars and was only nominated for Best Supporting Actress and Best Score. Again, a victim of politics. Apparently, the chief of production at MGM hated musicals. And in those days, studio employees were often told how to vote for nominees and ultimately the winners in the Academy Awards. And he instructed them at MGM to vote for Ivanhoe. It was true politicking of its worst, which allowed Singing in the Rain no purchase within the Academy Awards that year. So not only did it lose to a Crash-esque film like Greatest Show on Earth, it wasn't even nominated. And the fact that High Noon or Ivanhoe, or High Noon or Moulin Rouge or The Quiet Man didn't win instead of The Greatest Show on Earth, that's also just unbelievable. I mean, to me, it's the biggest overall travesty, right up there with the crash year that the Academy Awards had. They had so many qualified winners, and they chose this Cecil B. DeMille film that was big and sprawling and epic, which is all typical Cecil B. DeMille, but that's about it. Nobody remembers The Greatest Show on Earth. They didn't remember it in 1953 after it winning the award in 1952. Yet Singin' in the Rain endures, and I'll finish up by quoting Roger Ebert. The verdict of the years knows better than Oscar. Singin' in the Rain is a transcendent experience, and no one who loves movies can afford to miss it. All of that adds up to Singin' in the Rain being my number one, the biggest snub in Best Picture history.
Wow, that one caught me by surprise coming from you, throwing out a musical as number one. Great film. That one I missed as far as what was there. I totally agree that High Noon and Quiet Man and Ivanhoe all should have gotten deserved. I freaking love High Noon. I don't know if it's the best movie musical of all time, but that's just me. But it's definitely one of the best for sure. And at the very least, how does it not end up as one of the nominees that year? That's just
absolutely
for sure. Well, my number one is something you mentioned before. We're going back into Spielberg Corner, and I agreed with everything you said. That's why I couldn't believe that you had it so low on your list, because I think it is one of the greatest movies of all time, especially for its genre, and that is Spielberg's 1981 Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, losing to Chariots of Fire. And don't get me wrong, I like Chariots of Fire a lot. I think it, as Kirk said, it's a beautiful telling of that story, but it doesn't come close to what movie Raiders of the Lost Ark is, nor the historical impact that it has, nor continues to have, as they are going to be still turning out one more sequel. And we'll discuss that, I'm sure, at a different time and place. But at the time, $1.3 billion in adjusted gross that this movie made, starring Harrison Ford, Karen Allen, John Rhys-Davies, Paul Freeman, Denholm Elliott, amongst others. And while Chariots has its stirring moments and the great cinematography, Raiders is almost the perfect adventure film. Spielberg just captured the feel of an adventure serial film from yesteryear, but brought all the special effects magic and tricks of modern filmmaking to make it great and smooth and so enjoyable. Great leading man, coupled with nonstop adventure, mystery, bad guys, set in amazing camera work, and a John Williams score, which is one of his best. And you have a new standard for adventure films in my mind. Even the sequels of the film can't match the magic of Raiders, and they're all good. It's a timeless classic. Unlike Chariots of Fire, it deserved better at the Oscars. That's my number one.
You would have thought that the Academy, who really likes to celebrate themselves and celebrate Hollywood, really would have been all in on this incredibly entertaining updating of the old serials. I mean, nobody's done anything like it since. And how do you top Raiders? I mean, I really would have thought they would have just stood up and saluted and said, that's Hollywood. That's how films are made. It's engaging. It's fun. It had a sweeping score. It had an epic feel. It had a great leading man. It's quotable. I mean, it checks so many boxes. Whereas, you know, Chariots of Fire, all I can ever remember is the slow motion running on the beach next to St. Andrews with the Vangelis theme.
Yeah. And watch. And I'm sure they'll do it again. But how many times over the past number of years, when the Academy puts together their montages of their homage to Where We've Been and great moments in cinematic history, how many times do they show the picture of Indiana Jones trying to put the sandbag down and take the golden idol head, or running from the giant boulder, or just a close-up of him, or him with the whip, or, you know, there's always a shot of Raiders there. It's one of their most iconic films in their own minds, yet it didn't win. Amazing.
Yep.
Now let's go to, speaking of sequels, let's go to Unlisted, the sequel. What are some of those movies that almost made your list, but did not?
Well, I'm going to put a twist on it and just kind of go back to some of the ones. I mean, this is, I think, the biggest disparity between lists that we've had on the show. I mean, we've only matched three out of the seven.
Yeah.
So as I go back and look, as I told you, the right stuff was one I should have looked at a little bit more closely. Not going to say it would have made the list, but I should have looked at that a little bit more closely. Same thing with The Dark Knight. Same thing with Back to the Future. You know, all of those I would have looked at a little bit more closely. What about you?
Singing in the Rain. You know, I definitely missed that one completely. Hoop Dreams is fantastic. I wasn't even thinking along the line of documentaries, but Hoop Dreams was amazing. But other ones that came close is from recent times, 2015, Mad Max Fury Road over Spotlight. Spotlight's fine. It's a good movie. It's got some wonderful performances. We've kind of seen this movie before with All the President's Men. And Mad Max Fury Road was huge and amazing. 1979, Apocalypse Now, losing to Kramer versus Kramer.
Yep.
That one kind of surprises me. 1958, The Defiant Ones, with Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier losing to Gigi. 1955, Mr. Roberts, comedy, losing to Marty, which is a great film. It's also one of the shortest Best Pictures, and Mr. Roberts won Supporting Actor for Jack Lemmon. Jimmy Cagney's fantastic, and William Powell's fantastic, and Henry Fonda as the lead. And then it was tough to give honorable mentions some of them because the competition was so close. Like you mentioned Citizen Kane, we talked about Maltese Falcon, or 12 Angry Men losing to Bridge Over the River Kwai. Jaws, another Spielberg film, losing to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, both very worthy movies. The Fugitive and The Piano losing to Schindler's List. Schindler's List was probably the right choice, but those two were both excellent, excellent films as well. And not just 2 years ago, 1917, losing to Parasite.
You know, I think you can go back and look. I was just looking through some of the nominees as well, and I don't want to, you know, keep going back. You know, 1980. Ordinary People won, but you had The Elephant Man, you had Raging Bull, you had Coal Miner's Daughter. Yeah. I mean, those are all worthy films as well. I think you can probably go back and find an argument, not every year, but almost every year. Mm-hmm. I think what we tried to do here was highlight the ones that were the most egregious as opposed to, well, this could have or should have. I mean, I think there's a lot of could have, should haves, or a lot of could haves, but there's a very few should haves.
Yeah, the year the Green Book won, it's escaping my mind right now, but there was four or five in that that were equally as good, if not better, than Green Book. So, yeah, a lot of competition some years.
Sure. 1976, Rocky, All the President's Men, Bound for Glory, Network, and Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Although my favorite year has got to be 1974, where you had The Godfather Part II, Chinatown, The Conversation, Lenny, all these great important films, and The Towering Inferno.
Yeah. Which I love as far as disaster films, but yeah, one of these things is not like the others. Sure,
it's a great popcorn film, but no.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree.
Point well taken. Well, we don't have a guest this week. Sorry about that, but so we will not be having the guest list, and we didn't put on a poll because this one was just too hard because you could list almost every single movie ever made for consideration. So we didn't do a poll. So there's no populist either. But in its place, before we wrap things up, let's quickly talk about the fact that in the COVID year of ourselves of 2020, a lot of movies were not shown. They were tabled for the next year. And so that means that's this year, and starting like now, theaters are starting to reopen and movies are going to be coming back into the theaters, hopefully with no setbacks through the summer, fall, and into the Christmas season. Some good ones have been held and some other good ones were scheduled for this time anyway. So what are some of the big ones that you are looking forward to there, Kirk?
Well, I'm a Marvel wonk, as I think you are too. Yeah. So I was excited by the trailer that Marvel just released a couple days ago that kind of illustrated what Phase 4 is going to feel like. So I'm looking forward to all the Marvel films that are coming out this year. I'm also looking for, you know, I love good popcorn movies, and that's essentially what was held back because a lot of the smaller films made their way through streaming, et cetera. But, you know, I want to see the new Fast and Furious movie. I want to see the Jungle Cruise movie. You know, I love when Disney takes chances, as much of a chance as this is, but I love the, you know, what is their take on the ride? We all have experienced the ride, and I'm sure we all have our ideas of what this movie should be. So I'm anxious to see, you know, how much of an adventure they can make out of Jungle Cruise. I'm looking forward to the new Bond film. I'm really interested to see what Daniel Craig does with his last outing as James Bond. And if the rumors are true, do they tip their hand as to the direction they're going to go for the next James Bond? Is it a woman? Is it a person of color? You know, what is the different direction that 007 may take? Gosh, what else? I mean, like I said, there's so many things that got held back, you know, just from the tent poles at our old studio, whether it's the Jurassic films, whether it's the Minion films, whether it's Fast and Furious, which I already mentioned, you know, looking forward to seeing those. So many of these blockbusters were held back, and it'll be a good chance to see some of them. What are you looking forward to seeing?
Oh, I agree.
And the new Ghostbusters film, of course.
Yeah. Ghostbusters Afterlife. The Marvel, yep. I agree with you. The Marvel ones I'm looking forward to the most are Spider-Man 3, No Way Home, and Black Widow, the origin story for Black Widow. Top Gun Maverick, you know, ships and planes, me, love it. Want to see what they do with that.
Yes.
And then it's a great year for musicals, which I love that. Spielberg's got his West Side Story coming out.
Oh, In the Heights.
In the Heights, the original Lin-Manuel Miranda piece. Dear Evan Hansen, which, you know, with the exception of Hamilton, was probably the most successful Broadway musical in the past 10 years. So that's coming out also. And Wicked, another musical. So four really big musicals coming out. Wes Anderson, I love Wes Anderson movies, and The French Dispatch is coming out. Pixar has got a new entry. Luca will be coming out. And then there's a movie that I don't know a whole lot about. It's called Don't Look Up, but it's Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence, and those two are almost always good, and they usually pick good projects, so I'm very curious about that. And then the new remake of Dune is coming out as well. So a lot of things to check out. It should be fun. Hopefully, like I said, we keep playing it safe, people get vaccinated, and we can keep going to the theaters for the rest of the year. That'd be awesome.
Absolutely. Completely agree. It's going to be a good summer.
Well, that about does it for this episode. We only have two more episodes left for season one. And so next time we're going to discuss greatest sporting events in the world. So that can be from almost any sport, any type of sport, just what are known as some of the greatest sporting events. And there will be a poll up in a few days for that. So vote, and Kirk and I will make our list, and we will discuss that next time. So visit our site at populouspodcast.net to find that poll so you can vote at the listeners' poll. We want to hear your voice. And please also subscribe to the pod and your favorite podcast, or on your favorite podcast platforms.
And those platforms you can find us on include Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, Google, iHeartRadio, Pandora, or wherever you go to get your quality podcasts. Populist is a member of the Buzzsprout community, and we are a Vintageer production.
And if you want to follow us, you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/populistpodcast. At Twitter at populist_pod, and on Instagram at populistpod. So follow us. You'll learn about what's going on, especially during our hiatus. We'll let you know when we're coming up and if there's any surprises coming up during the hiatus. But we appreciate all you guys for listening. We had fun. Good list, Kirk. Fun talking movies with you as always.
A lot of fun. This was good. I like the fact that we had as much variety as we did. It just goes to show that with a lot of these topics, we can have a number of different directions we can go in and explore. And this was a fun one. You made me think about a few things.
Yeah, it's nice to know that we are not the Borg. We do not have just one conscious thought.
Very true.
All right, everybody. Good seeing you. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Stay safe, everyone. We'll see you in the movies. Bye-bye.